Really?
Her eyes light up, the way another girl's might over new shoes.
When can we see it?
Soon. I pluck the dish towel from her hands. Go shower.
Will you wash my hair?
Yes. She's only been doing it herself for a couple of months, and the results are uneven. Yell when you're ready. As I'm stacking plates back into the cupboard, my phone rings in my back pocket. The screen shows that it's my friend Gwyneth. Hey, what's up? Not canceling on me, are you? We walk every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, right after the kids go to school. She's a stay-at-home mother with a vibrant mummy blog, so her hours are her own, the same way mine are.
No, but Joanne can't make it. Want to hike Takarunga?
Joanne doesn't have as much time as the two of us, so we save more vigorous hikes for when she has to go to work early. We have to coordinate ahead of time because I like having a camelback for it, which I otherwise leave at home.
Love it.
In the background, a dog barks furiously, and she says,
See you at 7:30, then. Cheers. Cheers.
As I finish up in the kitchen, the dogs come tip-tapping in, the two who were orphaned when Helen died in my rescue, Ty, short for Tyrannosaurus Rex. He was named when Leo was in his dinosaur phase. He's a golden retriever mutt, overjoyed to have friends to play with. Outside, kids? I ask, and they sweep their tails. Paris and Toby are a little lost. Paris is a black German shepherd, too thin, with the saddest eyes I've ever seen. She's a big dog with long, beautiful fur, and I bend down to stroke her as she walks by. She allows it, but I think her heart is heavy. I make a mental note to look up ways to help heal a grieving dog. The other, Toby, is much smaller, maybe a Shih Tzu or Lhasa mix, in need of grooming, but otherwise pretty stable. He's white and brown with cheery black eyes, and to my surprise, Simon has gone gaga over him. Already Toby knows he can jump up into his lap when he's sitting on his big chair. A ripple of lightning edges along the horizon as I open the door, and I smell rain walking toward us over the water, carrying the scent of ocean and sky. Better hurry, guys. I stand in the doorway, breathing it in. The soft, gathering twilight and the two-note song of a pair of tuis. A seagull sails on currents overhead. The water undulates in green and opal with slight edges of purple. A storm is unmistakably moving in, and I look at the barometer in Sarah's little shed, but I don't know how to read the bubbles and weights. Paris does her business, then comes back over to me, sitting on alert next to my leg.
You're a sweetheart, aren't you?
I rub her long ears and she allows it, but she's scanning the perimeter in case of invaders. I might really fall for this dog. She reminds me of Cinder, the retriever mix we had when I was a child. It was Cinder who alerted us to the stranger at the door the night Dylan washed up at Eden. A storm had lashed the windows that night, too, and it whipped the ocean into a wild monster that Kit and I watched from our living room in the little house that perched so precariously on the cliff. On clear days, you could see 100 miles, at least, according to my dad, and all of it was ocean. Ocean that changed minute by minute. Ocean that changed color and texture, sound and mood. You could look at the ocean 1,000 times a day in exactly the same spot, and it would never appear the same. But that night, it was wild. Kit and I told stories to each other about shipwrecks. In the morning, we should go down and see if anything washes up from the ships, I said.
Booty!
Kit cried, her 5-year-old fist punching the air. Behind us, Cinder jumped up and barked his deep, warning bark. My mom came out of the kitchen, wiping her hands. It was a slow night at Eden because of the weather, so we were home for once, although she wasn't cooking. Why would she, with my father's stuffed squid to devour? One of the kitchen staff, a girl named Marie, had brought up a bowl of pasta with bread and herby olive oil, and we sat together eating it. When my mother answered the door, a boy was there, soaked and shivering, his long hair stuck to his neck and forehead. His chambray shirt and jeans clung to him, and his face was bruised and bleeding, as if he'd washed overboard from a wrecked ship, or he was the ghost of a seaman who had drowned and didn't know it. We read lots of stories like that, Kit and me. I read Far Above My Age and loved reading to her from a battered copy of The Big Book of Pirates, filled with tales of shipwrecks and ghosts and mermaids seducing sailors to their deaths. Much of it was over our heads, but it fueled our imaginations for years. My mother brought him inside and fetched towels and a mug of tea. Kit and I stared, captured by his beauty. He was barely a teenager, though at the time he lied and said he was 15, so his skin still had the dewy sheen of boyhood, stretched over elegantly assembled cheekbones and jaw. His eyes were the color of abalone shell, silver and blue and hints of violet, as if he'd been born in the sea. I whispered to Kit, "Maybe he's a merman." My mother was not known for taking in strays, not cats or dogs or people, but she took to Dylan as if he were her own child. She shifted Kit to my bedroom so there was a place for him to sleep and gave him a job in the restaurant, washing dishes. "You girls need to be nice to him," she said, tucking us in that night. "He's been through a lot."
"Is he a merman?" Kit asked.
My mother smoothed her brow. "No, sweetheart. He's just a boy." A boy she took in and nurtured from that moment forward, as if he were a lost cat, with no explanation whatsoever. Just a boy. For a long moment, standing beneath the lightning-lashed sky over Auckland, I think how small that phrase is. How true and untrue, all at once. A thudding ache pulses in the center of my chest. What if my mother had called the police to report a runaway? What if he'd been sent to a foster home instead of taking root in our family the way he did? Instead, my mother simply lied to everyone and said he was her nephew from Los Angeles. No one ever questioned her, and in those days, my father let her have her way over almost anything. The dogs, impatient with my wool gathering, swore my legs and licked my fingers. I bring them in, then go wash my daughter's hair. Later, Simon is watching a movie, some kind of adventure through a jungle with lots of mud and things that bite and cut and a sturdy man leading the way. His favorite thing. He doesn't love to read, but he watches all the sci-fi and adventure movies that exist, and when he runs out, he calls up YouTube videos in the same realm. I'm sitting next to him with my laptop, a blanket over my legs because it's gone quite cold. He's drinking a ginger beer and popping peanuts into his mouth every so often, while I have a cup of green tea that's probably cold. I only have it as company, really. I'd been pinning ideas for Sapphire House to Pinterest, and then I found a bunch of recipes for feijoas, and now I'm knuckling down to look up more of Veronica's backstory. My friend Gwen is enchanted with Veronica, and has often regaled me and our friend Nan with stories about the Auckland legend. I've long been intrigued by her rise and tragic end. I feel a tangled connection to her attempt to make herself over, become someone new, and she was successful at doing so. But, like a female Icarus, she was punished for her moxie and died young. On YouTube, I download the movie that launched Veronica's career. She'd been in Hollywood for several years and played many parts, mostly in the Jungle Girl realm. But when sound arrived on the scene, Veronica was cast in the role of a vixen, unapologetically ambitious and beautiful, and the sparks flew between her and her co-star. There's a famous kiss, and a dress so sheer and clinging that she might as well have been naked. Watching, I'm shocked at the liberal tone of the script and the saucy tongue-in-cheek way Veronica played the part. Her body in the famous dress is incendiary, a slipping, lacy bodice that gives the illusion of nipples, or is it that it's nipples giving the illusion of lace? Curvy hips, slim arms and waist. The big surprise is the intelligence of both script and actress, plus the fact that this cheeky vixen actually wins at the end. It's as if someone turned the rulebook on its head. Clicking around, I find more info on the era, very short-lived, called pre-code. For a brief 5 years between the establishment of the sound movie industry and the 1934 enforcement of the Hays Code, there were no morality guidelines, and movie makers took full advantage. Dozens of movies were made, often with overtly sexual themes and often with women in roles that acknowledge their sexuality and their ambition.
It startles me that there was so much freedom of story, of power in women's hands, such a long time ago. For the space of a few breaths, I wonder how life would be different for women if those stories had been allowed, embraced, even celebrated. Veronica Parker, with her elegant long limbs and sexy voice, had made her name there. In 5 years, she'd made 13 movies, nearly 3 a year, and she'd been paid handsomely for it, $110,000 a year. It sounds like a lot of money for the early 30s. Depression years, and I look up the equivalent to now, roughly $1.5 million a year, clearly enough to build a beautiful house that she barely had a chance to live in. Postcode, Veronica was not able to land parts in Hollywood as freely, and a director in New Zealand lured her home with promises of starring in a tragic romance, but the movie was never made. According to Wikipedia, the director, Peter Voss, was involved in dozens of scandals around women. His photo shows a handsome blonde man with an arrogant brow. I can't find the reason the movie wasn't made, aside from creative differences. Veronica found work in smaller parts, always as the vamp or dangerous other woman. Curled in my blanket, I wonder how that felt for her, to rise to such heights and then fall out of favor when she was still so young and had so much to give. Melancholy creeps under my skin and I close the laptop. I'm off to bed, I say to Simon and kiss his head. Don't stay up too late.
No, I'll be up soon.
I make a mental note to find some more of her movies and watch them. Maybe Gwyneth will want to join me. She's going to flat out faint when she finds out we bought Sapphire House.
Chapter 7. Kit. Jet lag wakes me at 4 a.m., and I try for a time to go back to sleep, but it's no use. The curtains are open. Office buildings stand between my balcony and the harbor. But the water lies in inky blackness between the edge of the downtown area and what seems to be an island on the other side. Little lights sparkle there, quiet, middle-of-the-night kind of lights. I lie on my side and imagine my sister in a house out there, fast asleep, the same moon shining on her that is shining on me. I imagine that she gets up to go to the bathroom and stops at the window, drawn by my intense gaze, and looks out toward the central business district and my window, invisible amid all the others. She feels me. She knows I'm here. When we were quite small, before Dylan arrived, we had our own rooms. But I was 5 when that ended, and up until I left for college, we shared. First the room that looked out over the ocean, when an open window meant the sound of the waves rocked us to sleep. Then in the master bedroom of the apartment in Salinas. It took me a long time to get used to the emptiness of a room that contained only my breathing. One of the things I love about Hobo is that he is company at night, curling up against the crook of my knees or creeping onto my pillow to rest his face against my head, as if we are two cats. I ache for him at those moments, and I wonder where his mother went, what terrible things he endured before I brought him into my house and let him stay. The thought of my cat makes me check the time. It's nearly 8 a.m. in Santa Cruz. My mom will be awake by now. I punch her number as I pad toward the little strip of kitchen by the door and fill the kettle. On the other end, the phone rings so long, I think she's not going to pick up. A familiar sense of disappointment and worry fills me. She has let me down and hasn't gone to stay with Hobo after all. I think of my poor cat, who trusts only me, and was so battered by the world before I took him in, alone in my house. At the very last minute, she answers, breathless. Kit, I'm here. You're there? At my house? A slight beat of quiet. She knows I don't trust her. I'm here, Kit. I was just out in the backyard watering your plants, and forgot I left my phone inside. Did Hobo come outside with you? Oh no, he hasn't even come out from under the bed. My stomach squeezes. I can see his black face so clearly, his tufted toes. You slept there? Yes, I swear. He is eating and using the litter box when I leave. I think he peed on your tennis shoes, though. You left them by the door. He's probably claiming me. Keep your stuff in the closet. I am. We're fine, kitten. The nickname is rare and sweet enough. Promise. I've had a cat or two in my life. Okay. It's only been a couple of days. He'll be fine. Just make absolutely sure he doesn't get out. I don't want him to come looking for me. I promise, she says in a very reasonable voice. And I realize I'm freaking out a little over a situation I can't control. Shocking. I take a breath and let it go. Okay, I believe you. Thanks. Now tell me about everything. What's it like? Is it beautiful? I walk back to the sliding door and pull it open, letting in a waft of muggy air, and step out to the concrete balcony 18 stories above the street. It's amazing. The water and the hills and these strange trees. It's gorgeous. I'll send you some pictures later today. I'd love that. Instead of rushing in with questions or comments, she waits for me to keep talking. A listening trick she learned at AA that would have made my childhood 10,000 times better. I visited the nightclub site, I say. It's hard to imagine what she would have been doing there, honestly. It seems like a club that was frequented by very young Asians, not middle-aged white ladies. Oh, she'd hardly be considered middle-aged. I raise my eyebrows. If she's really still alive, she's almost 43. Once you cross the line of 40, I think you have to admit to middle-aged. She makes a dismissive noise, and I hear her light a cigarette. The cigarette she thinks I don't know she smokes. Well, what's the next step? I honestly have no idea. Maybe you could take a picture around to the businesses in the area. Ask if anybody knows her. That's not a bad idea. Crime TV has its uses. I laugh. Well, if you come up with more tips, feel free to text. This is not exactly my forte. If anyone can find her, you can, she says. What if I don't? Then you don't, she says firmly. All you can do is try. Across the immense miles, I hear a blue jay cawing in my backyard in California. It reminds me acutely that I am a very, very long way from home, with no one but myself to keep me company. The loneliness of being unmoored from my little patch of geography, without the cat and, okay, I admit it, the mother I am used to seeing every day is stinging. I will do my best, I say. Please keep trying with Hobo. He needs love. I will. I bought him some tuna last night, and he did stick his nose out to get some. I laugh. Good idea. Thanks, Mom. I'll call you soon. I settle cross-legged on the bed with a cup of tea on a tray. The cups in the apartment are tiny, and I will need to buy a mug somewhere today. I saw a Starbucks on my travels, but it seems kind of pathetic to visit a brand I know perfectly well when I'm 7,000 miles from home. Opening my laptop, I bring up a map of the area around the nightclub and scan the names of the shops in the buildings nearby. I'd already seen that it was an area of high tourist volume, with cafes and restaurants of all kinds and shops full of postcards and t-shirts. But off to one side is a shopping area that looks more upscale, the Brita Mart, and it seems to have a higher grade of restaurants, coffee shops, boutiques, and such things. Would that be Josie's kind of place? It's hard to even imagine who she'd be now. As emotion, anger and fear, and a weird sense of hope starts to gurgle low in my gut, I don my scientific hat. How do you age a person who actually faked her own death and started fresh in a faraway land? Why did she do it? What has she done with her new life? How might she have spent the past decade and a half? Sipping my tea, I watch a cleaning crew vacuum a floor full of offices in a building across the way. Ponder the possibilities. One of the last times I saw Josie, she'd come to visit me in San Francisco. I was in med school, studying day and night, and she blew into town the way she always did, calling me on a payphone from somewhere near the beach. Can we get together? I close my eyes. It had been at least 6 or 8 months since she'd been in town, but I didn't have time. She would want to party all night and eat everything in my meager kitchen, and then go out to get more takeout, and she'd expect me to pay, even though I had zero money, and mostly ate baked potatoes with whatever crappy leftover veggies I could find on special at the supermarket, or else ramen noodles by the truckload. I'm on rotations, Josie. Just a cup of coffee or something. It's been a while, Kit. I miss you. Yeah, me too, I said by rote, but I didn't. I'd missed her fiercely 100 times in my life. But on those long, lonely days in Salinas after the earthquake, when she dived entirely into her dual addictions of surfing and getting high, I'd finally realized she was never really coming back to me. I just have a lot of studying to do. That's cool. I get it. Med school, dude. I'm so proud of you. The words plucked a string somewhere deep in my gut, and the reverberation released 1,000 memories, all reminding me of the ways I loved her. I took a breath. I'll meet you somewhere. Where are you? That's okay, sis. Seriously, I get it. If you don't have time, you don't have time. I just wanted to say hi. Where are you going after this? Not sure. The waves are great in Baja, but I'm kind of over Mexico. Maybe Oz. A bunch of us have been talking about finding space on a freighter or something. The more she talked in her raspy, beautiful voice, the more I wanted to hug her. Look, you know what? I can spare a couple of hours. Really? I don't want to interfere with anything. You won't. It might be ages before you're back in San Francisco. I'll come to you. Where are you? We met at a burger joint not far from Ocean Beach. Some guy with a tangle of blonde hair and at least 3 leather bracelets on his arm dropped her off. Josie tumbled out of the truck, looking like a creature from a Charles de Lint novel, an urban sprite or fairy walking amid the mortals. She was deeply, deeply tan from her year-round surfing, her hair impossibly long, cascading over her lean arms and past her waist. She wore an India cotton peasant blouse over jean shorts and sandals, and every male from the age of 6 to 96 stopped to admire her. A backpack, battered but strong, hung from her left shoulder. When she saw me, she broke into a run, stretching out her arms, and I found myself moving toward her, allowing her to fling her slim, taut body into my arms. We hugged hard. Her hair let loose the scent of a fresh breeze, a scent that made me ache to go surfing, to leave this grind I'd put myself in and run away to the beach with her. Oh my God, she breathed in my ear, her arms fierce around my neck. I miss you so damn much. Tears stung my eyes. By then, I had my guard up with her, but within 20 seconds, she swept me into her realm. Me too, I admitted, and this time it was true. For 1 minute, 2, I held on to her, dizzy with love and no thought, only her lean body against mine, her hair in my face. I stepped back. You look really good. Fresh air, she quipped, then touched my face. You look tired. Med school. Inside the diner, still in touch with the 70s, with its red Naga hide booths and chrome appointments. We sat by the window and ordered cheeseburgers. "Tell me everything," she said, sipping cherry Coke through a straw. I floundered, trying to think of something that wasn't a grind of books, rotations, notes. I was third year, on the floor for the first time, and it was both exhilarating and devastatingly exhausting. "I don't know what to say. I'm working hard." She nodded eagerly, and I noticed how red her eyes were. "Hi, as ever." "Well, what did you do yesterday?" "Yesterday?" I took a breath, trying to remember. "I got up at 4, so I could get to the hospital in time to do early rounds. Then we had rounds with our team, which is surgical, so I'm working with surgeons and residents. I scrubbed in for a gallbladder removal and an emergency appendectomy." I paused, feeling sleep, like a hook on a slow-moving train, start to reel me under. I blinked hard, shook my head. "What else? I met a study group before dinner, then ate, then went home to read for rounds this morning." Her eyebrows rose. "Dude, do you ever get to sleep?" I nodded. "Sometimes." "I can't believe you're going to be a doctor. I always brag about you." "Thanks." They drop off the burgers. And all the salt and fat smells so good. I bend in and breathe it deep. I'm freaking starving. "Not much time to eat there either. Do you get to surf?" "Sometimes. Not a lot, but it's okay. Eventually, this part will be done, and I'll be like everybody else." She pointed a fry at me. "Except you will be Dr. Bianchi." I grinned. "I do love the sound of that." I arranged the pickles and tomatoes on top of the cheese, and then added swirls of mustard. "What about you? Tell me about last week." She laughed, that low, raspy laugh that made everyone lean in close. "Good one." She took a bite of her burger and nodded as she chewed, as if she were thinking about all the things she could tell me. She held her napkin in her lap primly, and in the action, I saw my mother. "I bet you do more in a day than I do in a month." She dabbed her lips politely, making sure they were ketchup and grease-free. "But actually, last week was bitchin' because we were chasing a hurricane up the coast, from Florida all the way to Long Island." "Wow," I felt a ripple of envy. "Biggest waves?" "Montauk, you'd love it there." "Okay, you got me. I'm jealous." "Yeah," she grinned that impish, charming, encompassing smile. White teeth, but not perfectly straight, because she should have had braces, and my parents never got around to it. Neither of us saw a dentist until we were in middle school, and only then because Josie had a very bad molar, and Dylan had insisted they get her in to see someone. "Have you ever considered surfing professionally?" I asked. She stirred her straw around in her ice, gave me a half-tilted smile. "Nah, I'm not that good." "Bullshit. You just have to focus. Make that the center of everything." She gave me a slow, one-shoulder shrug, her mouth twisting into a wry dismissal. "No fun. I don't have your drive." I ate my burger for a time, focusing there, on the food that wasn't from a box or a bag. "I'm so proud of you, Kit," Josie said again. "Thanks. How's Mom?" "Fine. You should go see her." "Maybe." Another dismissive lift of one shoulder. "I'm not here for long." Maybe I was jealous. Maybe I missed her. Maybe it was a combination of both. But I said, "Are you just going to wander around your whole life?" She met my gaze. "What would be wrong with that? You need a job, a profession, something you can do to support yourself when I'm old and ugly." "No," I scowled. "I don't have your brains, Kit. I was a bad student, and no college is going to let me in. So basically, I can suffer along at some pissant community college, or I can do odd jobs and surf and love my life. Do you love it? A flicker over her eyes before she lowered them. Of course. I didn't want to fight. Good. I'm proud of you too. Don't say things you don't mean. I ducked my head, and it was all nothing but polite until the end. She ate every bite on the plate, right down to the lettuce leaf, then blotted her mouth. Cloudy light fell through the window to her bright hair, the tips of her eyelashes. A part of me was suddenly three, leaning on her as she read aloud to me, and five, tucked into a sleeping bag next to hers under the shelter of a tent. The images made me ache. How much I missed her when she deserted me. How much I still did. I looked away, thought of my immunology test. Facts and figures, facts and figures. Do you ever think of what might have happened if Dylan never came? She asked suddenly. Or if the earthquake hadn't wrecked the restaurant? Her words slammed into a heavily fortified box in my heart. I try to look forward. What if, though? What if Dad was still up there at Eden, cooking, and maybe Mom got her act together, and we went home for weekends or holidays, and Dad told jokes and... Stop. I closed my eyes. An ache along the bottom of my lungs. Please, I just can't. Her face was haunted, adding luminosity to her cheekbones, depth to her dark eyes. What would have happened to us without him? She shook her head, turned those tortured eyes on me. Our parents were horrible, Kit. Why did they neglect us like that? I don't know. My words were hard, erecting a wall against the past. I have to focus on the present. Again, she ignored me. Why couldn't we save Dylan? She turned that gaze on me. Tears edged her lower lids, never quite spilling. Don't you miss him? I clenched my jaw, swallowed away my own grief. Of course I do, all the time. I had to pause, bow my head. But he wasn't savable. He was already too broken when he showed up. Maybe. Her voice broke slightly, going husky. But what if things happened to make him take that last step? I mean, what things, Josie? I was both impatient and weary. She had gone over this subject a million times when we were teenagers. He was always going to die young. Nothing pushed him over the edge except his own demons. She nodded, dashed away a tear that dared fall, and stared out the window. He was happy for a long time, wasn't he? I reach out and take her hand. Yes, I think he was. She clutched my hand tight, her head bowed, her hair falling in a curtain around her face. The obscuring mists of my emotion cleared, and I could see her objectively, as if she were a stranger who'd wandered into the ER. A too-thin young woman with dry skin and chapped lips. Dehydrated, I'd note. Probably an addict. I wanted, suddenly, to take care of her. I miss all of it, I volunteered. Dad and Dylan and Cinder. My voice grew croaky. I swear to God, I miss that dog like a limb. Best dog ever. I nodded. He was. I shook my hair out of my face. I miss the restaurant, the patio, the cover, our bedroom. I take a breath. Sleeping on the beach in our tent. That was the best. It was. She ran a fingertip over the scar on her forehead. The earthquake wrecked everything. I guess. A little burn of impatience edged my spine. Dylan and Cinder were already gone. I know that. Why do you have to be so mean in the middle of something like this? It's not mean, it's just reality. Facts and figures. Yeah, well, reality isn't always what you think it is. Sometimes things are more complicated than simple facts. Like our parents, like our childhood, like the earthquake. You weren't even there that day, I said, a rare moment of furious honesty. I had to sit there on the edge of the cliff by myself for hours, while I knew Dad was probably dead down there. And all you ever seem to remember is that you got a cut head. Oh, Kit, she grabbed both my hands. Oh my God, I'm sorry. You're right. That must have been terrible. I didn't take my hands away, but I closed my eyes so that I didn't have to look at her. I know it was bad in Santa Cruz too, but... She slid out of her side of the booth and into mine, flinging her body around me. I'm sorry. I'm so selfish sometimes. The smell of her, the essence of Josie, unlike any other scent in the world, enveloped me. And I was lost in my love for her, my adoration, my fury. The hungry, lonely cells of my body drank it in for long minutes. Then I extracted myself. Life is always a mixed bag. I guess so. But I can't imagine who we'd be without Dylan. Can you? I didn't even want to. It doesn't matter. It is what it is. It was my turn to look away, out the window, to the promise of the ocean on the blank blue horizon. I could really use a walk on the beach after this, I offered. Maybe find some mermaid coins? That would be really lucky, she said. That was the day we impulsively got our tattoos, sitting side by side at a tattoo parlor near Ocean Beach as twilight moved in. I run my fingers over the tattoo. It's elegantly, delicately drawn, and I've never regretted it, though I've never done anything that impulsive before or since. Maybe I just wanted to be close to her again. Lucky, I think now, sitting on my bed in Auckland, watching a band of light leak into the horizon. It wasn't like she'd had much, something I'd always been too self-righteous to see. Josie, so beautiful, so lost, so smart, so doomed. Who would the woman I saw that day in San Francisco have become? Will I find a party girl, somebody still surfing the world? She's pretty long in the tooth for that now, but I wouldn't put it past her. Or maybe she's found a way to be connected to her passion and work with it, like the woman who opened a woman-centered surf shop in Santa Cruz. Or maybe she's just a pothead, smoking her life away. I sip my tea, which is going cold. It's probably not the latter. At some point, she must have turned herself around or she wouldn't have survived. Her addiction had become so extreme by the last time I saw her that nothing short of a miracle would have saved her. On the laptop, I bring up the image of her from the news. It's a surprisingly clear shot, and there's nothing dissipated or weary about that face at all. The haircut is expensive, sharp, or maybe just recent. Her face is not bloated, which tends to show up on long-term drinkers. And in fact, she doesn't look a lot older than she did 15 years ago, which is classic Josie. She's still beautiful, still lean, still herself. Where am I going to find her? I walk to the sink, dump the cold tea, fill the kettle again, and lean on the counter while it boils, my arms crossed. In solving medical puzzles, I've learned to always, always go back to the actual known facts. A patient presents with something mysterious, start there. Stomach pain and rash. What did she eat? What has she been doing the past 24 hours? How old is she? Live alone? Eat with friends or family? Take a shower? So I start where I am with Josie. No, scratch that. Start with a fact. A blonde woman with a scar exactly like my sister's was filmed at the site of a nightclub fire 5 nights ago. The kettle clicks off, and I pour boiling water over my tea bag in the tiny cup and wish for a mug that would last a little while before I putter back to the computer on the bed. What time was the blonde woman filmed? I have to look that up and find the timestamp. 10 p.m. New Zealand time, which would have been 2 a.m. my time. Just about right. I must have caught the news as the first reports were coming in. Okay, what would have been open on a Friday night at 10 p.m. in that area? Pretty much everything I discover. All the restaurants, all the clubs and bars. But again, facts. She is a woman of means, judging by the haircut and the expensive sweater. Maybe she had met friends. I scroll around the map, looking at possibilities to add to my list. One establishment leaps out at me. An Italian restaurant in Britomart, the upscale shopping area next to the harbor. I send the directions to my phone. I'll go down there and show the photo around. Maybe somebody will have seen her. Even better, maybe they know her. Maybe she's a regular. But nothing is open until much later. It's just now gone 7, and I'm restless. The building has a pool. I'll head down there, do some laps, and then come back up and get ready to go out.
Chapter 8. Mari. I'm frying eggs from Sarah's hens when the earthquake hits. It starts low, that slight disorientation you get that feels like maybe you turned too fast or lost your footing, and then the sound, the tinkle of glasses in the cupboard. Urgently, I turn off the gas and shout for my family, running for the door to open it and let the dogs out. The birds are hushed as I dash outside. For a little while, I think I'm going to be okay this time. It's not violent, just a slow, easy tumbler, more of an aftershock than quake. The kids are still inside. I hear something rattling and the thud of something falling over in the shed, and I think I should go check it out, but I'm plastered to the trunk of the palm tree, my cheek pressed hard into the bark, my arms straining. I gauge the intensity of it from long experience. Not a 6, but maybe in the high 4, low 5 range. Enough to knock things from grocery shelves, tools from the shelves in the shed. I wonder where the epicenter is. Who is getting it now? Maybe it's offshore, and the damage will be minimal. There have been some substantial earthquakes in the country since I arrived, the worst being the 2 back-to-back that nearly destroyed Christchurch, and another just a couple of years ago on the South Island near a little tourist town. Simon mourned Kaikoura, a place he'd visited a lot as a child. I'd never been there, but Simon said the destruction had been very bad indeed. The city is recovering, finally, but it has taken a long time. Auckland feels the quakes, but they're not centered here. It's always somewhere else. Instead, they cheerfully predict a volcano will someday incinerate the city, but it's the kind of thing you can't believe will ever happen. Unlike the earthquakes that remind us, over and over, that they can do whatever they want. The earth finally stills, but I'm still clinging to the trunk like a 5-year-old. Mari! Simon yells, and I hear him running. His hand, that big, solid hand, covers my upper back, but I still don't let go. Not until he peels one arm, then the other, off the tree and settles them around his waist. You'll be right, he says, a peculiarly New Zealand phrase. No worries. I smell the sharpness of clean cotton in his skin below. His chest is as solid as a wall, his body the thing that will save me, always. Sarah and Leo are suddenly beside me too, their hands on my arms, my hair. It's okay, Mummy. You'll be right. Enfolded in their love, I can take a breath, but they don't rush me. I'm sorry, you guys. I wish I could get over this. It's so silly. No worries, Mum, Leo says. We're all afraid of things, Sarah adds. I snort and look at her over my arm. Not you.
Will, not me, but most everybody.
My chuckle eases the rigidness of my body, and I force myself to straighten, to let go of my husband, to kiss my children's heads. 1, 2. Thank you. I'm good.
Simon's hand lingers on my upper back.
Get yourself a cup of tea. I'll finish breakfast.
I used to protest, but a counselor finally told me that the more I resisted the emotions of my PTSD, the worse it would get. To overcome it, I have to be present with it. So I head inside and pour a fresh cup of tea. The screen of my memory flashes with images from the earthquake that gave me the scar on my face. The noise, the screams, the blood everywhere from the wound on my head and the wound in my belly. All of it. I stare into my cup of milky tea. On the surface, my kitchen window is reflected in a white rectangle, interrupted by the line of pots along the bottom. I force myself to take slow, even breaths. Same in as out. 1, 2, 3 in, 1, 2, 3 out, and slowly my trembling eases. The voices of the children, lilting up and down, smooth the goose flesh on my arms. I sigh, letting go. Simon, frying bacon, a bibbed apron around his body, gives me a smile.
Bitter?
Yep, thanks. We eat normally, and Simon loads the children in the car and turns to me. His gray eyes are filled with concern as he brushes hair away from my face. He knows I suffered through a massive earthquake, though I lied about which one it was.
Take the day off.
I'm hiking with Gwyneth and then meeting Rose at Sapphire House to make some more notes.
The walk will be good.
His palm cups my cheek.
Go to the CBD and visit the Cat Cafe or something.
I give him a grin.
Maybe. I really think I'm all right.
He presses a kiss to my forehead, lingering a second longer than usual, then squeezes my shoulder.
I've got the swim fundraiser tonight. Don't forget. The kids and I will be late.
Our division of labor means I don't have to participate in the swim stuff, which I find stultifying. The long, long hours, the drives to various places, the chit-chat with all the other parents. I know women knit and read and whatever, and I do show up for the big meets, but Simon loves it madly, and I don't. In return, I do a much larger share of housework and laundry and shopping, which he loathes. But I had forgotten about the meet tonight, and a little knot stuck in my throat as I lift my hand and wave them off, the three of them in a single car, the only things in the world that really matter to me. Maybe I'll call my friend Nan, see if she wants to meet for dinner in the CBD. A good plan. I met Gwyneth on the ferry. I was pregnant with Leo, irritable in the summer heat, tired of Christmas in the summer, suddenly longing for family now that I'd be adding to it. I missed my father, weirdly, after so long. I'd found myself imagining how my mother's eyes or sister's mouth might look on a baby, if I would see my family in the hands or laughter of a child. I even grieved the fact that my mother would not be there when the baby was born, but perhaps all women feel that way. Pregnancy made me so emotional, in fact, that it frightened me. I constantly worried about the dire things in the world, what might befall a child I loved so intensely before it was born. Simon had gently pointed me toward the city and an exhibit on the Bloomsbury Group, which both eased and stimulated me, just as he'd known it would. Gwyneth sat down next to me on the ferry, a tall, slim woman with a stylish air, and offered me an ice cream.
Hokey pokey, she said.
Can't go wrong?
As far as I'm concerned, no ice cream goes wrong.
I paused.
Except coffee.
You're American.
Canadian, actually. She narrowed her eyes.
That's what you'll say, though, isn't it?
I laughed and stuck to my made-up story. I grew up on the west coast of British Columbia, Vancouver Island.
Hard to take the island out of the woman, she said, nodding. I saw you at the exhibit. Which one is your favorite?
Vanessa, completely. That Earth Mother vibe? I want to go live in her farmhouse. You?
Duncan. I'm madly in love with him, of course. I know exactly why Vanessa loved him.
She licked her ice cream.
I've been to that farmhouse. You can feel her in every room. I wrote a dissertation on the farmhouse itself, as a design idea.
I fell right under her spell. We talked art and artists, then books and writers, all the way back to our respective homes. Hers only 4 blocks away from mine, and we've been fast friends ever since. This morning, she's waiting for me in our usual spot, near the water. Her long blonde hair is pulled back in a high ponytail, and she's wearing a tank and North Shore leggings that show off her long, lean figure.
"Earthquake this morning. Did you feel it?" she asks.
I give a curt nod. No one outside my family knows how badly I react to tremors.
"Did you hear where it was centered?"
"Offshore."
She gestures at the water sudsing restlessly, splashing hard against the land.
"Good."
"Hmm."
We set off at a brisk pace, hands swinging. Sometimes we can walk a long way without talking, but today my news is so momentous, I can't wait.
"So, we bought a new house."
"Already? The last project was only finished last week."
"Right, but Simon heard through the grapevine that Veronica Parker's sister died."
She stops dead, her mouth open.
"No."
I raise my eyebrows.
"Yes. You are looking at the new owner of Sapphire House."
"You're joking."
Her face is both blank and blazing.
"No, it's done. He bought it outright."
"Good God. He's even wealthier than I thought."
I take her upper arm and move her body toward the trail that circles up a mountain on the north head of this finger of land.
"His father still owns great gobs of land."
"Oh my God," she cries. "You know I love her so much. You have to take me inside."
"Of course, I want your help."
"When can we go?" "Not today. I have tons of work to do, but this weekend?"
"Yes, absolutely. I told the kids we could go over there, too. You can come with us."
"Are you flipping it?"
"No."
I pause as we start walking up the hill. The sun is bright and hot on my shoulders.
"We're going to live there."
"No, you can't."
Gwyneth flings her arms up.
"I need you here."
"It'll take a while."
"Oh, but then you'll be way over in Mount Eden, and I'll never see you anymore."
"No, we'll make a date and meet in some fab coffee shop in every neighborhood in Auckland once a month." She takes a sip of water from her bottle.
"All right. And you'll have to have grand parties in that house."
"I will. I promise." We start to climb seriously and focus on our breath while we acclimate.
Hey, can we bring it down a notch?" I gasp.
"Sorry."
She slows.
"We should have a welcome party or something."
I take a long gulp for my Camelback. "That sounds like fun. I'm not sure when we'll fit it in, but we can try."
"I know."
She gives me a wide-eyed glance.
"When did everything get so busy? I was never so busy when I worked."
"You didn't have children. Each child takes approximately 48 hours per day."
"Ah, that's what it is. No one told me that."
We hike in silence for a while.
To our right stretch the harbor and the irregular coastline of the city. To the north is Rangitoto, an uninhabited volcanic island popular with tourists. In the far distance stretches a line of mountains meeting the sea, the whole scene painted in blues. Blue water, blue mountains, blue skies. I never thought I would find a place more beautiful than the Northern California coast, but this is outrageous.
Amazing. I never get tired of that view. That's why I never leave. I wanted to as a girl. Go to Paris and New York and all those places, but I visited and none of them matched this.
I was luckier than I could have expressed to have washed up here. It was all blind luck, ridiculous timing, a good decision made at a moment of crisis. My throat tightens at all that I would never have known. And right behind it, a subtle worry crawls down my neck again. That television camera, right on my face the night of the club fire. I had been in the CBD with Nan and was headed back to the ferry when I saw the news crews. Before I registered what was going on, I stared right into it for the space of 3 heartbeats. Careless, but honestly, how many news events happen on an average day? Not even a cataclysmic nightclub fire would spend much time in the spotlight. At the top of the headland, we pause briefly, leaning on a bunker built in World War II, and catch our breath. It's one of the best views I know of anywhere, the islands in Rangitoto, the skyscrapers of the CBD, the quaint tumble of villas along the Devonport seafront.
We are so lucky, Gwyneth said.
Yes, I bump her shoulder. We have each other.
Sisters, she says, flinging an arm around me. Forever.
No one will ever be my sister except Kit, but I can't bear a life without close female friendships.
Sisters,
I agree, and lean my head on her shoulder, looking east across the water to where my sister lives. For a faint, foolish moment, I wonder if she is looking toward me, too, across time, across the miles, somehow sensing that I am still alive.
Chapter 9. Kit. I ride the elevator down to the 8th floor. It's still very early on a Friday morning, so there aren't many people about. It's between the crack of dawn before work crowd and the post-school run moms. The area is nearly empty, only one person swimming laps. The pool is wildly inviting, full Olympic length, the water a rich turquoise, maybe 3 lanes wide. Windows look out to the high-rise building forest, and I'm cheerfully anticipating a good swim as I kick off my flip-flops. The man in the pool is swimming vigorously, powerfully, and comes up for air at the far end where I'm standing. Damn. Of course it's Javier. Of all the gin joints in all the world, I say.
Pardon?
He gives the word its Spanish intonation as he wipes water from his face. A face, I note with some despair, that is just as fabulous as it was yesterday. Maybe even better. Never mind, I say, and pick up my towel. I won't bother you. He easily hauls himself out of the water and stands there with wet skin and powerful shoulders and modest swim shorts still showing a lot.
No, no, please. I'm nearly finished. You can have the pool.
Stay. It's plenty big enough for both of us.
Sure?
I feel like an idiot. I'm sorry about last night. A twitch of his shoulders. He gestures to the water.
Erase?
That's not fair. You've warmed up.
Warm up then.
He sits on the side of the pool, folds his hands. Light trickles over his skin, and I look away, cast off my wrap, and braid my hair, knowing that he's looking at all my parts. The suit is a one-piece designed to contain my chest and modestly cover my butt, but it's not exactly a garment that leaves much to the imagination. Securing my braid, I slide into the water. Ooh, I sigh. Ozone. I dive under the surface of the silky pool and kick my way half the length before I come up for air, swim hard to the end, and turn back to the start. He's still sitting on the side. His legs are covered with black hair.
Impressive.
You can't just sit there and watch, I protest. You have to swim.
Let's swim then,
he agrees, and slides back into the water himself, taking off without warning. So we swim. Laps, mostly. I'm conscious of his skin, only an arm's length away. I'm conscious of my own skin, swept by the water. And then, as always, I forget anyone else and the problems of the day and meld with the water, moving easily, rhythmically, the world forgotten. I don't even remember learning to swim, any more than I remember learning to walk. He stops before I do, hooking his elbows backward over the wall, his hair slicked back. I keep swimming, but then I'm worried he'll leave before we have a chance to talk, which is backward from what I wanted last night. But maybe for once, I'm going to go with what I actually feel instead of what I think I should. When I lap back, I come up and pause. Are you leaving?
Do you want me to?
I shake my head.
There is a spa pool over there,
he says, and points to a door going outside.
I will wait there if you like.
Yes, please. He doesn't smile, and neither do I. I lean back into my stroke and do a few more laps before I give in to the lure of him and climb out, wrapping a big towel around my waist, which is ridiculous because then I just take it off. The spa pool is protected, but it is outside, with views of the office buildings around us. I drop my towel on the chair. "How is it?" I ask.
"Quite good."
I step into the hot, swirling water and sink down, letting it cover me to my neck. He sits on a higher ledge, and I can't help admiring his well-shaped arms, the black hair on his chest. He's ever so slightly overweight, carrying the extra right over his belt line, which makes me like him more. The sign of a man who relishes life, or travels a lot, I think, remembering that he said he'd been on the road too much. He doesn't speak, only dabbles his hands over the water. "Fair enough." "Sorry I bolted last night," I say. His dark eyes rest on my face, and he lifts an eyebrow in question. I can't hold the eye contact and look down at my hands, floating in the blue water. I shake my head. "I don't know." "Look, it was stupid, and I'm sorry. Can we start fresh?" He turns his lips down in consideration.
"Okay."
Offers a hand.
"My name is Javier."
I laugh. "Not all the way at the beginning."
"Did you like my song?"
"You have a beautiful voice."
"Thank you."
He slides deeper into the water and lets his feet rise, the toes poking up into the air. It seems strangely revealing.
"Perhaps one day you can hear more than one song."
I give him a wry smile. "Maybe so."
"How long will you be here, in Auckland?"
"I'm not sure, really." I take a breath and find myself telling the truth. "I'm sort of on a mission to find someone."
"Not a lover, I don't think."
His toes disappear beneath the surface. "No, not at all. My sister."
"Did she run away?"
I sigh. "It's a very long story."
"This is your sister who died?"
I forgot I told him that.
"Yes."
I give the answer a shortness that conveys my unwillingness to add more. He nods, his eyes fixed on my face, as his hands swirl over the water. Graceful, strong, beautiful hands graced with square nails.
"Will you look for her today?"
A trickle of water makes its way down his cheekbone, slides along his mouth. I want to put my open palms on his bare shoulders. "Yes, I found some leads, but I probably won't be busy with it all day." He smiles at last, and beneath the water, his foot brushes mine.
"What if I help you look, and then you come with me on a sightseeing tour?"
I think of not having to spend the day entirely by myself. "All right, I'd like that."
"Do you want to know what we will see?"
With a smile, I shrug. "Whatever it is, I've never seen it before." His smile is generous, considering.
"Nor I."
Suddenly, there is a sway, a splash, and I feel off kilter. It's not my imagination. Javier tilts toward me, a hand reaching behind me for the lip of the pool. I lift my head, looking for things that could fall on us. Then I'm clambering out of the spa and heading for open space. "Come on."
"What?"
The sway, not terrible, but unmistakable, comes again. "Earthquake," I say, and hold out my hand. He wastes no time, and we hurry out to the open passageway that leads back to the pool.
"Is it dangerous?"
"No." I rest my hands on the wide stone ledge. Sunlight floods the area. "Very minor, but you don't want to be under anything that could be shaken loose." He looks up, but there's nothing above us, only sky. The sway is less remarkable here, out of the water, and soon it's gone. "That's that," I say.
"How did you know it was an earthquake?"
"I live in Northern California,
They're part of the landscape. Have you ever experienced a big one? I think of the cove, scattered with the decayed ruins of what had once been Eden and our home. Yes, unfortunately, the Loma Prieta in 89. Then add the way everyone remembers it. San Francisco. How old were